Gallatin Valley. This is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Dr. Nurse Nancy. Our producer is Robin Fly. Along with another Gallatin Valley resident, I just visited Hawaii. Of course, I enjoyed the climate and the scenery, but I especially appreciated learning about Hawaiian history. If you're fantasizing about getting out of the Montana cold and traveling to the islands, you might want to think of yourself as a visitor to another nation. Today's program is about the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom and the ongoing illegal occupation of Hawaii by the U.S. Joining us today is Dr. Keanu Sai, Chairman of the Council of Regency, the body acting as the interim government of the Hawaiian Kingdom. Among other accomplishments, Dr. Sai served as the lead agent for the Hawaiian Kingdom in arbitration proceedings at The Hague from 1999 to 2001. He has a PhD in political science, specializing in Hawaii constitutionalism and international relations, and he is a professor at the University of Hawaii. Welcome, Dr. Sai.
Thank you.
Your specialty is international law, but most of our listeners won't be lawyers. So I'd like to begin by asking you a little bit about what the Kingdom of Hawaii was like before the overthrow. Kind of give us that picture before we get into legal details. I have come to learn through you and your work that the government and society were really very sophisticated and progressive. Could you talk to us about, for example, education and literacy in Hawaii before the overthrow?
Well, Hawaii has a close tie with Great Britain. So in 1794, King Kamehameha I joined the British Empire. And that really started Hawaii on this road toward being progressive. As a British protectorate, Hawaii was recognized as an independent state by Great Britain in 1843. Hawaii had adopted 3 years before that recognition, the first constitution, making Hawaii a constitutional monarchy, where Kamehameha III opened the country up for sharing of power with him as a monarch. So very unique. And it also, the Hawaiian Kingdom brought in a theory of economics that was not pervasive in the 19th century. And that was from Francis Whalen from Brown University, where his form of capitalism, as opposed to Adam Smith's version of capitalism, right, dealt with more cooperative nature aspect of economics, thus planting the seed for Hawaii to be what would be called a mixed economy and a welfare state, where a welfare state takes care of the welfare of its citizenry. And this led to universal health care by 1859, This led to compulsory education nearly 70 years prior to the United States compulsory education. Hawaii's literacy by 1830 was second to Scotland. So this kind of gives you an idea of the Hawaiian Kingdom as a country, but also it was also recognized as one of four neutral states in international law. So the Hawaiian Kingdom was a neutral state along with Luxembourg, Belgium, and Switzerland. So pretty much that's what Hawaii was, and it was very progressive.
And the citizenry was, I was surprised to learn, was actually pretty multi-ethnic. Is that right?
True. So the term for Hawaii's nationality is called Hawaiian subjects. Like British is a short term for British subjects.
Okay.
Hawaiian is a short term for Hawaiian subject. So you can acquire Hawaiian nationality by birth on a soil, natural born, or you can apply for naturalization. Now, the majority of the nationals of the Hawaiian Kingdom were Aboriginal or Native, along with the leadership, the monarch, but it was multi-ethnic. So I believe by 1890, 86% of the national population were Aboriginal, 14% were non-Aboriginal, but all having equal rights under Hawaii's constitutional system, where they had both civil and political rights.
I find that fascinating. And you just mentioned the word Aboriginal. So when I first read your work, I saw that you used the term occupied, not colonized, to describe Hawaii's current status, and also that you used the term Aboriginal, not indigenous, to describe Native Hawaiians, Aboriginal Hawaiians. Could you explain for our listeners what occupation means and how it differs from colonization, and also why you use Aboriginal and not indigenous?
Okay. So the term occupation, which is more particularly called belligerent occupation, is a term that is used in international relations and international law, where one state, an independent state, through military intervention or being at war, occupies the territory of another country or another state. That situation there is called belligerent occupation. And the laws of war would begin to apply once an act of war, which would lead to the belligerent occupation, has been initiated. Okay. So one of the primary rules of international law with regard to when one country belligerently occupies another country is the duty for that occupying country to administer the laws of the occupied state during its occupation until it gets a treaty of peace that would transfer the country's sovereignty to the conqueror. Without a treaty, the rules say that you must administer the laws of the occupied state because you bore the responsibility of overthrowing that government of that occupied state. So when you now speak to the term colonization, colonization does not apply between independent states. Colonization is an act by which one state will effectively control through occupation, meaning mass migration of its citizenry to territory that does not belong to another state. Okay. So the case of the United States of America is a clear example of that. So the East Coast of the United States, you had 13 British Crown colonies. Okay. The British occupied the eastern coast of that non-state territory in order to develop its colonial position, which would be a signal to the other countries like France or Spain that Great Britain is carving this area up as its territorial possession in a colonial context, right? So colonization can only take place between a state called the colonizer and the territory of a non-state, meaning a state that is not a part of international law. Now, what will kind of create some problems here is that you had Native American nations that were there, okay? But the state of international law in the 16th, 17th century, and 18th century did not recognize Native American nations as independent states. So they viewed the territory of the Americas subject to discovery and colonization by the European powers. Okay. Now, if a country like France is occupied by Great Britain, okay, let's say in the 19th century, that occupation by Great Britain over French territory would never be considered colonization. It would be considered belligerent occupation because France was a state and Great Britain was a state. And that's how you would interpret it. So when you look at Hawaii, colonization does not apply because Hawaii, like France, is an independent state. So being an independent state that the United States had recognized explicitly in the 1840s, it prevents the United States from ever claiming, or any foreign country from ever claiming, that they can colonize Hawaii, because that would be tantamount to saying America can colonize Canada and Canada can colonize Mexico. It's just nonsensical. It doesn't apply. But when the use of the term colonization has been used from a rhetorical standpoint, it only builds upon a false narrative that the United States has sovereignty in Hawaii when it doesn't.
And we're definitely going to get more into that. I want to just touch also, though, on the terms Aboriginal versus Indigenous, just so our listeners are clear.
So from a historical standpoint, in the 19th century, Hawaiian subjects of the native blood referred to themselves as Aboriginal Hawaiian, right? So it's not like I came up with that term to use Aboriginal. My great-grandparents who lived in the Kingdom era in the 1880s were Aboriginal Hawaiian subjects, okay? Now, the term Aboriginal, as opposed to the word Indigenous, is important to know, because Aboriginal, by definition, applies to humans as to the first arriving in certain regions of the world, okay? So it's first to arrive. So the Aborigines in Australia, that is not the embodiment of the term Aboriginal. It just means that the Aborigines in Australia were the first to arrive. Now, they did not call themselves Aborigines because they weren't speaking English.
Right.
They had their own term that they referred to themselves. So when you look at the word Aboriginal, first to arrive in a region, clearly natives, my ancestors, were the first to arrive in these islands as they were Polynesian. Okay. Now, when we get into indigenous, indigenous is used to identify plants and animals that distinguishes itself from human contact. So it makes a distinction. So the word indigenous means originating in a particular region that has not been affected by human contact. So a plant or animal can only be called indigenous prior to any human contact, right? So clearly indigenous and Aboriginal have two completely different meanings. One, Aboriginal applies to humans, and indigenous applies to plants and animals that distinguish it from human contact. Now, when we look into the term indigenous peoples, though, now that's a political term. And that term was created in the 1980s at the United Nations. So the United Nations, its working group on indigenous populations, were looking into the disparity of native people, tribal people that exist within independent states, United States, Mexico, right, South America, and indigenous peoples is a political term that refers to tribal nations within an existing state, okay? And that's important because indigenous peoples are non-states, but rather exist within states, not of their creation, because either through conquest or colonization, right? So when you refer to Native Hawaiians or Aboriginal Hawaiians as indigenous people, you are implying that Hawaii was never a country and that it is a tribal nation that exists within the United States, similar to Native Americans. That's not our history. We are an independent state, and that's the difference. So you have these narratives that are based more on rhetoric than any basis of evidence or facts. So when I use the word Aboriginal Hawaii, that's because I don't use the word indigenous people, because that only reinforces that false narrative that the United States has Hawaii as the 50th state, when in fact, it's completely untrue. Yeah.
You're listening to Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman. Our guest today is Dr. Keanu Sai. Dr. Sai is chairman of the Council of Regency, a body acting as the interim government of the Hawaiian Kingdom, and a professor at the University of Hawaii. We are talking about what history-minded visitors to Montana, from Montana to Hawaii, might want to know about the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom if they want to understand more about their destination. So, this is a pretty big question, but how did Hawaii become occupied? What can you get? I know you teach hours and hours and hours on this, but What were some of the milestone events in that process?
I think before we can get into the specifics of what actually took place, it's important to give a context.
Okay. Right?
This would be international law, right? So whenever you look at certain facts, you need some theoretical framework that would be able to explain these facts, without which it wouldn't make sense.
Okay.
So a common misunderstanding, right, is that what was overthrown in 1893 was the Hawaiian Kingdom. That's not true. What actually was overthrown illegally was the government of the Hawaiian Kingdom. That's different. Mm. Because the rules of international law, which is the lens that we're going to use to understand the situation, because this is between two independent states, the United States and the Hawaiian Kingdom. Hawaii had an embassy in Washington, D.C. The United States had an embassy in Honolulu. Okay, so it gives you an indication of that status that Hawaii has with the United States, albeit small, but equal under international law. So the primary rule of international law is to distinguish and separate the state from the government. Okay, so the state is also called the country. And a country called a state has a government that exercises its authority, right? Because a state itself is a juridical person. It's a legal person, right? And the only thing that defines a state, an independent state, is defined borders, a centralized government, citizenry and residents within that territory, and the ability to enter into foreign relations. These are four attributes of what international law refers to as a state. Now, the government is not a subject of international law. A government was created by a state's domestic law, right? Whether that's constitutional, whether it's autocratic, whether it's run by oligarchs, it's domestic, right? So the state, being recognized as an independent state, is a subject of international law. But a state cannot speak on its behalf without a government. So I'll give you an example of a juridical person that could not speak without some physical body. Bank of America, okay? So Bank of America is a corporation. It's a legal person. It's a juridical person, right? It was incorporated as articles of incorporation. But Bank of America cannot speak on its own. It needs a board of directors with a chief executive officer, right? Okay. And that is how it can speak. Now, if one day officers of the board of directors and the chief executive officer does not show up for work, that does not mean Bank of America ceases to exist. It's just sitting there idle, right? Now, you take that concept, which is a rule of international law, dealing with the Hawaiian Kingdom as a legal person, a state. The government speaks on its behalf, and that government is that progressive entity that I was speaking about earlier that established a high literacy rate, second to Scotland, that established universal health care. The state didn't create that. The government did in exercising the authority of the state. And that authority is called sovereignty. So with that, according to the rules of international law, which apply equally to the United States, when it overthrew Saddam Hussein's government in 2003 in Iraq, Saddam Hussein's government was overthrown militarily, but not Iraq as the sovereign state. And the United States thereafter had to administer the laws of Iraq, and that's called belligerent occupation. So that's a recent example of it. So what happened in Hawaii was on January 16th, 1893, the U.S. ambassador who was running rogue, right, because he was trying to get Hawaii to be a part of the United States so that they could take advantage of Pearl Harbor for naval purposes, a military and strategic outpost. So this U.S. ambassador ordered U.S. Marines to land and invade Hawaii on January 16th, 1893. In Honolulu. That led to Queen Liliʻuokalani and the Hawaiian government to surrender conditionally to the United States president and to ask and to direct the president to investigate the actions of their ambassador and the U.S. troops that have landed in violation of international law. President Cleveland was the president that initiated the investigation in March of 1893. That investigation lasted until December 1893, when he notified the Congress. And that is where he identified the fact that the United States invaded a foreign country and that the illegality of that act was the violation of the rule of international law, which is the duty to not intervene in the internal affairs of another country. So basically what the U.S. ambassador did was he propped up a few insurgents who included Americans and Hawaiian subjects and other foreign nationals, propped them up as a provisional government so they can enter into a treaty with the United States to transfer Hawaii to the United States. President Cleveland's investigation undermined that plan because he found that the whole thing was illegal. And he withdrew that treaty from consideration by the Senate, and he entered into an agreement to restore the Queen as the head of government.
Well, what happened then? Because that didn't happen.
Well, what's happening now is President Cleveland, what he's doing is he has to restore the Queen as the head of the government. But by the mere fact that he is negotiating with the Queen after the overthrow is an indication she's still Queen and the Hawaiian Kingdom still exists, but she's just not in power yet because of their insurgents that the United States had propped up before. So that agreement to restore the Queen to that position as a constitutional monarch, it was opposed by people in Congress. So they prevented President Cleveland from carrying out that agreement, which is a treaty between the Hawaiian Kingdom and the United States, because they wanted Pearl Harbor. So they're going to just tell the president by passing a resolution in Congress, do not intervene in the internal affairs of Hawaii, which is kind of absurd because this whole problem derived from intervention in the first place. But now the congressman is saying, no, President Cleveland cannot interfere. What they were doing was buying time, right? So eventually, President Cleveland was replaced in 1897, March of 1897, by President William McKinley. William McKinley reinitiated negotiations with the insurgents who are now calling themselves the Republic of Hawaii to have a treaty. So a treaty was signed in Washington between the insurgents and President McKinley.
Even though they were not the real legal government.
Yeah. And that prompted the Queen, who was in Washington, D.C. at that time, to file a diplomatic protest with the U.S. State Department saying exactly that you just said, that they are insurgents, that they are not lawful, they are not the government of Hawaii. Now, President McKinley, though, in order to follow U.S. law, the treaty that he entered into with the insurgents needed to be approved by the U.S. Senate, and that's called ratification. So 2/3 of the senators have to approve or ratify that treaty that is transferring all of Hawaii to the United States. Okay. Now, that prompted Queen Liliʻuokalani in Washington to communicate back to Hawaii in order to initiate a signature petition drive. And this is where they're going to gather signatures to show that it's not just Queen Liliʻuokalani as the head of state protesting, but also all the people. And these protests, called a signature petition, were brought to the United States Congress when it would reconvene in December of 1897, because when the treaty was signed in June, during the summer, the Congress was out of session. When they came back into session in December of 1897, the petitions were read into the record by Senator Hoare from Massachusetts. He was on the side of the Queen. So that was read onto the record. And from that point, when the session opened, the Hawaiian delegates that came from Hawaii that represented the Hawaiian Patriotic League and the Hawaiian Political Association went to every senator who voiced their opinion that they would ratify that treaty. And by March of 1898, the Hawaiian delegates succeeded. The Senate could not get enough to ratify the treaty, so the treaty was dead. Now, at this point, the Hawaiian Kingdom is still on its own, but it's going through the civil unrest that was initiated since the invasion on January 16, 1893 by the United States Marines. So the delegates came home celebrating. They won. They preserved Hawaii's autonomy. 1 month later, though, in April, everything would change. The Spanish-American War broke out. And now the United States is going to find themselves fighting the Spanish, not just in the Caribbean, but also in the Pacific, Guam and the Philippines. Mm-hmm. And a few days after, Admiral Dewey defeats the Spanish fleet in Manila Bay, Philippines. Representative Francis Newlands reports to the committee in the House Committee on Foreign Affairs a proposed joint resolution for annexation. Now, the problem here is that a proposed joint resolution of annexation is an American law. It's an American process. It has no effect outside of U.S. territory. Okay. But nevertheless, they're going to push this joint resolution for the House and Senate to agree. Now, Senator Pettigrew, okay, Senator Augustus Bacon, Representative Thomas Ball from Texas, they're all going to put on the record, you can't annex a foreign country by passing a law, because our laws have no effect beyond our borders. What was the response from the annexationists? We're at war. This is a military necessity. We need Hawaii as a military outpost to fight the Spanish in Guam and the Philippines. That was a justification. And then on July 7, 1898, President William McKinley signed the joint resolution of annexation. And that began that process of the false narrative that Hawaii was colonized and made a part of the United States.
You tell that story so grippingly. And it's such a complicated story with so many ins and outs, and I feel like you really drew clear lines for me to follow. I appreciate that. Listeners, this is Body Politic on KGVM Bozeman 95.9 FM. Join us in the next half hour as we continue talking with Dr. Keanu Sai about the ongoing illegal occupation of Hawaii by the U.S. You can hear Body Politic at 1 p.m. on the first and third Monday of every month, stream it live at kgvm.org, or check out the KGVM website to hear most Body Politic shows as podcasts.